Arriving in Madagascar, I was really, really enthusiastic and hopeful that I was on a mission to help this community to thrive, to help them overcome overfishing. And a lot of it has been kind of like scientific research. So the first thing I was going to do was to look at the social dimension of it, which include a lot of going from household to household to interview about their attitudes and perception about different coastal and marine ecosystems, whether it was a mangrove and what they thought about them, whether it was some kind of spiritual connection or, you know, some haunted places and everything it entails. And also collecting a lot of demographic information. So there I was in this village. I went from household to household with my mantra, trying to convince them that if you do this or do that, you can protect, you know, you're going to get this in return. This village elder, he looked at me and he said, why are you doing this? I went, where do you come from? Why are you coming, you know, from the other side of the world to our community? What's in it for you? Why are you doing this? And I continue my mantra like this, you know, you're going to improve, I want you to improve your livelihoods. And, you know, but he kept challenging me and saying, yeah, but for what? For what? It was very linked to kind of Western values of kind of prosperity. And I'm thinking, yeah, okay, what can I tell him? He's going to be able to buy a house that has a proper door or, you know. He stopped me and he said, you know what, you Westerners, like, you spend your whole life overworking and all you want in the end is just to own your own little place, to sit by the water and go fishing. And you spend your whole life working. And by the end of the day, that is your end goal. And he's like, I have that.
Greetings, merfolks. I'm your host, Danny Washington, and welcome to season 2 of 21st Century Mermaids. This podcast is called 21st Century Mermaids because it shares stories of women all over the world who are working to explore, understand, and protect ocean ecosystems using science, technology, storytelling, and determination with a ton of swagger and style. Guests we feature are actively contributing to the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science, a global initiative that began in 2021 on a mission to create transformative ocean science solutions for sustainable development, connecting people and our ocean. We consider the brilliant ocean warriors we interview on this podcast to be the epitome of what it means to be a modern mermaid: intelligent, talented, intriguing, and fierce. These soulful sirens are using their talents and skill sets to turn the tide toward a healthier relationship between humanity and our beautiful big blue planet. What's up, mermaids? Danny Washington here. I'm so excited for you to be back on another episode of 21st Century Mermaids. Today, we've got a wonderful guest who has just returned from a very important meeting in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. And I'm so excited to introduce you to Minna Epps. And she is an incredible human being who is working for the ocean full time, currently the director of the IUCN Ocean Team, or the Global and Marine Polar Program. And if you don't know, the IUCN stands for the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Minna has worked in several different spaces over the last 20 years with lots of experience in the marine space, as well as, you know, field work and policy and the Marine Stewardship Council. There are so many different things that Minna has worked on over the years, and we're just really excited to have her on the show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you, Danny. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Well, we're definitely thrilled to have you. And here at 21st Century Mermaids, we are always telling stories of women who identify as someone who is working for the ocean, for the future of our ocean, and for the future generations as well. So I'm curious, how did you begin this work? Where did you become interested in the ocean? What's your origin story?
My origin story? Water has always been like a neutral and a natural place. I think that's always been quite comforting. So there's not kind of a distinct moment or episode, whether a trauma or a realization of its beauty. It's just always been a natural and a neutral space. So I guess it's just an unconditional love.
Unconditional love. Are there any other memories that you've had in the ocean that have been significant for you?
Yeah, I think a lot of it comes from maybe storytelling. So my mother had a love for the ocean, and I was born, I grew up in Sweden, which is, the water's pretty cold there. So I didn't spend too much time in the water, but it was mainly the kind of stories as when she was young, she went to Baja California, and basically those stories about the warm water and the Sea of Cortez and diving for abalone, etc. So I think that was always kind of that romantic. And I loved, anyway, being by the ocean. And it was, you know, quite calm, but looking at the surface. And as I said, the water was pretty cold, but, you know, it still didn't stop me. I spend a lot of time, if it was too cold to be in the water, I wanted to be on the water in any form, whether it was, a canoe, kayak, a boat, whatever. I just love, you know, being on the ocean. And I guess also the other side of my family is from California. And I remember going as a child to like Pacific Ocean, which was like, you know, have these massive waves and energy. And it was just so mesmerizing to kind of be and feel that kind of energy and the power. And most of what I thought was also interesting is on the coast in La Jolla Cove, the wave kind of bashes in and it leaves with us kind of these tide pools, the tidal pools. And I was just like, spending, you know, time looking at these different tidal pools and see what's in there and what brought in the little community. So as a lot of people, you think, oh, you're a marine biologist, you love, you know, the megafauna. But I've always been quite intrigued by kind of invertebrates and, yeah, the intertidal ecology.
Intertidal ecology is magical. And La Jolla is certainly one of those blue gems on the California coast. I love La Jolla so much. The water is cold, as you mentioned. But did you ever go snorkeling or scuba diving in the kelp forest in that area?
I did, definitely. I've done some kelp crawls as you come up from a scuba dive. And yeah, it's definitely worth it. I mean, the kelp forest is absolutely magical. So kelp forest has always had kind of a special place in my heart.
Definitely. And so tell us about your early career. You began at the Rhode Island School of Oceanography and UC Berkeley. What was your experience as a college student studying marine science?
Well, it was actually before that. Actually, how I ended up studying marine biology was actually, I wanted to be a medical doctor and we wanted to study in London. When you fill out the form, you have kind of six options. And I had only filled out five and I was away. So my mother took the liberty again. And she said, put the sixth option down as marine biology.
Really?
Always dreamt of going to Hawaii. So that was actually the first offer I got. It was really quick. So it was the first one. It was an unconditional offer. I just thought, yes, why not? But I studied actually marine biology, not in Hawaii, but in London. You can imagine in the field trips, it was marine and freshwater. So a lot of the field trips were kind of in the Lake District or in the streams or up in the coast of Scotland and different places. So again, the water was freezing cold and you have to be in it with your waders. That's how I started my marine biology career. And, you know, if you look back, it kind of looks like a red thread, like it was all planned, but it was really different circumstances leading me to where I am today, basically.
Mm-hmm. And what was that transition like when you realized that you can contribute to protecting the ocean through policy in tandem with science?
Well, that's a really interesting question, because I would say I started studying like marine biology basically out of, you know, curiosity, fascination, before I even know, you know, that we needed to protect the ocean. When I was a student, I mean, the problems of the ocean was basically down to overfishing, and again, caused by humans. So I spent most of those years kind of studying down, looking at different kind of plankton through a microscope. And then I realized when I graduated, it's like, okay, so when I was thinking about the ocean and how we needed to protect it, I just thought you needed to protect it from overfishing, because that was the main problem you discussed around the ocean. So not so much the impacts of climate change and other things. So I then basically started doing postgraduates, looking at much more in terms of the resource management. And I also always been a people's person. And I realized that whatever you need to fix or whatever you need to work with people. So that's kind of how I kind of segued into that. And I would say, I wouldn't imagine at the time that, you know, as a marine biologist, you would be working for the UN or WTO or, you know, it's not the most obvious. And I did end up doing that, but I was most of the time the only biologist. Yeah. So I kind of started out at the European Commission first as a kind of a paid trainee for the fisheries and scientific analysis unit. And again, the research around that was really about fisheries management, and all the research going into that was actually about fisheries management, not the broader aspect or the ecosystem aspects of it. So that was quite interesting. And then that kind of led to the next thing. And I remember a friend of mine calling up and saying, I was just finishing my term in Brussels. And she said, oh, why don't you come to Geneva? And I said, oh, what would I do there? And she goes, oh, actually, I'm going to go tomorrow and turn down a job as an environmental economist. And he said, I think it's got something to do with fisheries. I can recommend you. And she did. And they said, okay, can you send your CV? And I did. And literally 5 or 10 minutes later, max, this woman calls me up from UNEP. And she said, okay, well, okay, possibly interesting. You know, how soon can you get here? And I said, yeah. So I got a one-way ticket on a train to Geneva. And they had piles of, you know, CVs with people with PhD from Ivy League universities. And they were all kind of economists, et cetera. And it was quite interesting because it was a job as an environmental economist, but it was about harmful fishery subsidies. This was really a long time ago. And I recently found some of those publications that I was editing, and you could apply them today. And it was actually only earlier this year when the WTO finally came to an agreement on ending harmful fishery subsidies. So it's you know, you have to have, I guess, a lot of patience to be in there. That's kind of how it started. And then I was at the WTO. And also when I was at the UN, I was doing a lot of policy work, but not having really been trained in that and not really having the region of connected to the things I was writing about. So it was just a lot of words. So I said, okay, but, you know, I really think you need a kind of on the ground experience. So I packed my bags and I went to Madagascar with a small NGO called Blue Ventures. And that was really, really an enriching experience. And still today, when I think back of that policy language, I try to think, what does it mean? And, you know, what are the implications of, you know, all these different words?
Yes, long sentences and lots of acronyms, especially if you work within the UN. The UN loves acronyms for the different departments and organizations within it. Can you give us a quick breakdown of what it means to be a part of the IUCN and the work that you do there?
Yeah, IUCN is quite a large organization, and sometimes even referred to as the world's best kept secret. It's one of the world's like largest environmental kind of network. It was established in 1948. So same time as the UN. So it's an intergovernmental organization, and it's a membership union, and it comprises of 200 state members, about 1,500 or 1,700 NGOs or civil society organizations, and they all are members. And that's basically, we have a members assembly that comes together every 4 years that really sets out the agenda for the world. I mean, the conservation work that, you know, the world needs to embark on. And that's kind of our highest decision-making power. So we are mandated by that. I'm based in Switzerland, which is where the headquarters is, but we have offices around the world. And I think that what's unique is not only like the power of the union, right? Because in addition to what I just described of the membership base, we also have specific commissions of experts. In total, I think it's now up to 18,000 experts. So they could be legal experts, they can be, you know, experts in seahorses, or, you know, it's extremely diverse pool of resources to pull from. So, and I think the uniqueness then comes from not only having a global reach, but because you're present in country offices and implement projects on the ground, you have that kind of reality check where you can actually apply certain tools and have the lessons learned and, you know, share. But then basically taking those local realities and connecting them to global policy processes. Because IUCN is a permanent observer to the United Nations, which means that, you know, we have observer status to cover a lot of these multilateral environmental agreements. So whether it's the UNFCCC, so the United Nations Framework for Convention on Climate Change, or as most recently now, which is the ongoing BBNJ, which is a treaty for the high seas, being an internationally legally binding treaty that's being negotiated under United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea. So it's quite diverse, I would say, but I think that's kind of the world that I work in. But again, I think I'm quite privileged because I work with, you know, ocean issues, and there's a whole ocean community out there with really like-minded, enthusiastic people that bring different expertise and qualities and skills to the table, all sharing that same passion of restoring ocean health, whether you're a lawyer, economist, or biologist, or et cetera. So,
and I just want to run on this tangent a bit, but what are your thoughts on investing in the ocean by restoring marine ecosystems along our coastlines, aka blue carbon?
Yeah, well, I would say in general, like marine protection is climate action. protecting the marine environment, we'll protect biodiversity. And we know that the marine environment, the biodiversity has declined quite steeply in the last 50 years. When it comes to, if we talk about it in the sense of blue carbon with regards to the climate crisis we're facing, I think the most important thing is not to kind of derail. The main duty that we have is really to cut and phase out fossil fuels. Blue carbon is often used as potential as offsetting. I mean, if you start with just investing in restoring and protecting coastal and marine ecosystems, which has many benefits, not only just to biodiversity, but it could be livelihood, reducing impacts of disasters or even preventing disasters. So it has a multiple of benefits. If we think about, again, in terms of offset, according to the IPCC, so the panel on climate change, yes, all these acronyms again, they estimate that, you know, the blue carbon offsetting, I mean, it's about 2% of our current emissions. So of course, we need to do much more on cutting emissions. I think another aspect as well, when we talk about also mentioning it in terms of like nature-based solutions, is that them themselves are a threat of climate change. And also part of the blue carbon, there's lots of debates in terms of, you know, not only the pricing, but the verification, et cetera. But it's also that kind of future scenarios and predictability. So I think, you know, we really have to think about what do we do today? So if we're talking about whether, you know, marine protected areas, sure, that can have the blue carbon aspect of it. But it's really about thinking about how do you make them climate proof? They need to be climate proof so it can be future proof.
Absolutely. And so a few days ago, you returned back from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, where COP27 happened. Tell us about your experience there. What were some of the success stories of the meeting and what do you think can be done going forward?
Yes, it was actually, I think that it was actually one of the most well-attended COPs. I think it was close to 40,000 people. So wow. That's huge. And it was held in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. So it was in the African continent. You know, we all kind of read the headlines and they love kind of saying, you know, calling things out as failure. And I think there were some good things and some bad things. I think the main headlines have probably focused quite a lot on the kind of failure of not phasing out fossil fuels or just talking about phasing out like coals, etc. But I think that one big positive thing was the kind of the loss and damage in terms of compensation. And I think that was, even if there's still a lot of details to follow in terms of, you know, setting up this fund and you know, how it will actually play out, it's still kind of more of a principle area. So I think that kind of helped a lot. And I think that was especially from developing countries is something that they've been waiting for quite some time. So I think that was still a major progress. But when it comes to the ocean, I think it was quite good progress. Again, we can always hope for more. But it wasn't until quite recently. I mean, at the last COP, the ocean was written into four places and we all celebrated. But it was really officially recognized as the important role of ocean in terms of mitigation and adaptation. The UNFCCC the Secretariat of the Convention has organized what they call ocean dialogues. So again, with different kind of speakers putting in different perspective, looking at what UN institution can do, it was civil society has particular, et cetera. I think now it was formally recognized to take that into consideration because it might not sound like it, you know, like rocket science, like why shouldn't you listen to these kind of advice of what came out of these dialogues? But there is a kind of process to that. And that was actually acknowledged as well as the need to have thematic deep dives on specific themes or issues. The other area where the ocean was mentioned was in relation to CDR, so carbon dioxide removal. And there's different ways that you can do it and, you know, semi-engineered or fully engineered. But this is where the policy is lagging behind in terms of what the private sector or even if the full science is not there, private sector interest is gearing up. And especially if, you know, you can bring it to market and make money out of it. So I think that's an area that really deserve some kind of precaution and, you know, a lot more research going into that so that we're not shifting and creating a problem elsewhere. I think that's an area that's evolving quite quickly because now in relation to climate change, there is also an ocean panel, so a high level panel on sustainable ocean economy. And they look to the ocean for the solutions to tackle climate change. And of course, you can have marine renewable energy. You can talk about blue foods, which is kind of your fisheries and aquaculture, but also looking at decarbonization of transportation. So I think as we look to the ocean for solutions, we also must kind of carefully consider any potential trade-offs. It was quite interesting, yeah.
That's fantastic. So what about some recent triumphs with you, specifically with you and your team at the IUCN? What recently has happened that has made you hopeful or optimistic about the future of our ocean?
It's hard to kind of pinpoint like one thing, but kind of definitely seeing progress. And I think it comes back to the timeline of things as well, because you might work really hard on something for a long time or you might even finish working on it. And then the kind of triumph comes like 3 years later when something gets adopted or whatever. And I think it's really a collective effort and how you contribute. And sometimes you're contributing by just encouraging or giving someone else the courage to be brave, to do something bold or different. But I think as a team effort, I think coming out of the pandemic, which was quite a difficult period to lead a team and to be inspirational and you get no external stimuli whatsoever. I think it was, we had to organize the World Conservation Congress in Marseille, IUCN, which happens every 4 years. And there was huge uncertainties around that because the pandemic wasn't over. So I was responsible for the ocean part of it. And it was the first time ocean was a major theme, you know, after 70 plus years of an organization. It was the first time.
Only 70 years.
Only 70 years, exactly. And I couldn't actually visualize it. How is it possible? And actually just relying on the network you have. So literally, again, kind of your friends and colleagues, I said, you know, this is the opportunity. We got to move the agenda forward. Like, can you come? And it was just quite overwhelming how many came and, you know, really contributed, putting it on agenda. And that really, I felt that was last year in September. So it was over a year now. But since then, it's been kind of nonstop. And I really felt that, you know, not only from a lot of resolutions that were passed, but so many connections were made, you know, just these things that you never know what they're going to bear fruit later on.
It sounds like you need to be prepared for delayed gratification and success with this type of work, especially when it comes to policy. Mm-hmm. Well, I think from there, I'd love to talk about what are some of the nuances? You mentioned a little bit about it, but when you're working with people and their personalities, you know, the communities that interact with the IUCN, what are some of the things that you take into consideration when you're working with them and building relationships with communities that are part of some of the negotiations or, like you said, some of the smaller fisheries communities? What have you learned from those type of interactions?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. So growing up in a kind of a cold country, and it's always this kind of dream. And, you know, once I finished studying marine biology, it was obvious that I wanted to go and work, whether with coastal communities, on small scale fisheries, etc. And I did, and several countries, but especially when you spend time in a community. So if I go back to the Madagascar example, I was there for some time, you know, living with the community and engaging and, yeah, seeing this different kind of dynamics. And what I learned was that after many years later, I found myself working with fishermen in the Baltic Sea. And it's incredibly similar, those communities. I mean, different parts of the world, but the dynamics and the different stakeholders are the same. You have the fishermen, which has a certain way of life. And I really felt like from, doesn't matter if I've been in Greenland or whether it's like Madagascar or somewhere else, it is a special community. And they are, you know, whether they're seafaring tribes or whatever, which are incredibly similar. And I think that was quite surprising to me. And the dynamics are the same. So I could kind of apply the same methodologies, kind of transferable skills. And I really learned that in all these different stakeholders and relationships, it's about really having the trust, and you're much more likely to trust your peer. So I think that I always try to find a champion within a different kind of group and then have them champion it and convince their peers, so to say. I think it's a much more effective ways. And I think that applies everywhere. Same thing in policy. You know, if you have NGOs, you know, trying to convince countries against their kind of national interest, if one state can convince the others, it's effective. I mean, they're much more inclined to kind of listen to your peers.
Mina, how do you think that we can cultivate more empathy for the ocean on an individual and community level?
Definitely empathy is key. Actually, going back to now, when I was just in Sharm el-Sheikh, there was an evening reception and high-level dinner and just very short speeches. So the climate change ambassador for France, basically, is going to make a short speech. And he said that he had gone snorkeling for the first time, or down on the water, looking at corals. And you could generally see that he was excited, like it kind of shined through. And then he started, you know, waving his hands. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. It was all these colors and there were fish. And, you know, you can really see that he just wanted to kind of run back into the negotiation room and said, hey, you know, we got to do something because in a few decades, the coral reefs might be gone. So I think being exposed to that is key to having a emotional connection. But I think we are making progress because both the political and the public awareness about the ocean and its importance. And it's not just, you know, the recreational value or a sentiment, emotional. It's actually comes down to real things. It's about our survival. And I think when people understand that and realize what implications, and we are seeing it, and there's still a lot to be done.
And so this podcast is an official activity of the United Nations Decade of Ocean Science for Sustainable Development. And of course, we support the protection of 30% of the ocean by 2030. I'm curious, how have you directly contributed to the achievement of this massive goal? I think you've touched on it so far. You've definitely mentioned quite a few projects, but is there anything that you can name that you think is a direct contribution to the protection of 30%?
The 30 by 30, I mean, that was something when I joined IUCN that kind of, it hadn't really taken off, so to say, but now it has. And you're seeing more and more and more countries signing up to it. And, you know, I think we're all part of it. And for example, I'm part of the ocean leaders, like Friends of Ocean Action, which is like different ocean leaders kind of really promoting the 30 by 30. You do it little by little. I think the contribution probably is that I'm involved in so many different kind of fora. So whether it's at the political level, I mean, the policy, right? So you can kind of spread the word and the message in multiple fora. And then I think having champions or pioneers carrying that message forward, then you spread that, hey, it's not just me saying this, look, here's all this momentum being in. So kind of amplifying those messages. So I think it's like awareness raising and spreading it, and we do it daily. And of course, we did have a resolution that was passed in I say by our members, but it's also mobilizing different groups of doing it. So it's not just, okay, the policy, you make a political commitment. I mean, it's also the role of philanthropy that we work with a lot. It's really kind of diverse, and you just have to tailor your message to the different groups that you are talking to.
So for our listeners who are intrigued by your career and what you've worked on, what kind of advice would you offer to them if they wanted to pursue something similar?
Yeah, that's a good question. As I said, it wasn't planned a red thread, but I think never be afraid to ask for help. That's really an obstacle that many people have. Don't be afraid and always think about what you have to say. It does matter. So I think whatever you want to pursue, you want to work in, you know, saving the oceans, the options of career options of how you can do that are just growing. You can be a coder, you know, you can work in fintech, you can work, you know, so many different things that will contribute to it. I got in the room and I wasn't intimidated, and I asked questions or it didn't make sense. And a lot of things were revealed. And then they said, okay, we do have a problem here. So it's like, it wasn't like I was going to come in and scrutinize, but I think that's the thing. It's not to be intimidated.
Not to be intimidated and to always ask questions. I love that. Well, now some fun as we wrap up. I'd love to know what your interpretation of a mermaid is.
Ooh, a mermaid. What is that? Goddess of the sea, right?
Yes.
Yes. I think someone is uniquely in tune with the world around them. I think going back again to the kind of ocean literacy, I think a mermaid would, you know, symbolize awareness and insight. Yeah, some kind of sacred feminine. And I know in a lot of culture, they refer to the ocean as in the feminine sense. So that's kind of my interpretation of a mermaid.
Wonderful. And what about your vision for the ocean by 2030? What do you hope the ocean will look like, and what will it evolve to be at the end of this decade?
It really, really, really depends on what we do now and what we do today and the decisions that we take, because it's changing so fast. And the best thing that we can do is kind of plan for the absolute worst and, you know, hope for the best. And I think that it is, as I said, gaining momentum everywhere. And although these political processes and policy are slow, the rest of the world is acting. You don't just have to rely on their, you know, other sectors or private sectors. They're taking this on and driving things quite fast. Well, first off, I hope that, you know, we have the ocean is a bit more quiet place, and that we have decarbonized the transportation. I think there's some things that we can do directly and that we have invested in, and that if everything goes well and it goes forward, I would then say in 2030, we will have 30% of the ocean protected and effectively managed and governed.
Absolutely. Love it. Love it.
"21st Century Mermaids" is a podcast created and executive produced by me, Danny Washington, Erica Woolsey, and Maria Soleil Bianco. Our editor and sound designer is Vagabond Podcast Productions. Thanks for listening, and catch you later, mermaids.